You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, and up next, a look at a case that has been dominating the headlines all week. It's just become the staple of 24/7 newscasts, and of course, we're talking about the Terri Schiavo case. Yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court refused once again to hear the appeal brought by the parents. Schiavo, as you probably know, is a 41-year-old severely brain-damaged woman who has become the center of a very public debate on how we decide what happens to a person who can no longer make decisions for herself, but who has not left behind a living will. Just to recap, in 1990, Terri Schiavo suffered cardiac arrest and deprived of oxygen. Her brain could no longer function properly. Unable to swallow, Schiavo has been receiving nutrition and hydration through a feeding tube. Last week, following her husband's wishes and years of legal wrangling, that tube was removed. Terri Schiavo's parents have tried to have the feeding tube reinserted, but so far their efforts have failed. Seizing the opportunity, Florida Governor Jeb Bush said earlier this week that he had new evidence provided by a neurologist that Mrs. Schiavo, instead of being in a persistent vegetative state, is actually in a, quote, minimally conscious state, unquote. That new evidence has failed to convince the courts that the feeding tube should be reinserted. So, where are we now? What do these terms mean? They've been thrown around all week, the last few weeks. How can neurologists ascertain what level of awareness a person has? And how does that awareness level play in the process? What part does it play in deciding what should happen to a brain-damaged person? So that's what we'll be talking about for the rest of the hour, trying to define these terms and understanding what awareness is. And if you'd like to get into the conversation, our number, 1-800-989-TALK, 1-800-989-8255. James Burnett is a professor of neurology at Dartmouth Medical School. He joins us by phone from campus. Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Timothy E. Quill is professor of medicine, psychiatry, and medical humanities at the University of Rochester Medical Center. He's also the director of the Center for Palliative Care and Clinical Ethics. He joins us by phone from his office there. Thank you for being with us today, Dr. Quill.
Glad to be with you.
You wrote earlier in this week that Governor Bush, Governor Bush said that there was new evidence that Terri Schiavo was actually, quote, in a minimally conscious state as opposed to a persistent vegetative state, Dr. Quill. Are these diagnostic terms, and what's the difference between them?
Well, I think Dr. Burnett probably can address these, that distinction better than I, but let me give it a start. And that is a persistent vegetative state, like what it appears Terri Schiavo is in, is a situation where the cortex, the outer part of the brain, is not functioning. So there is not consciousness, awareness, ability to interact with the environment, the ability to feel pain. But the base of the brain, the sort of basic functions, are still intact. So her base of her brain still works in the sense that it can regulate the bodily functions. She does have awake and sleep cycles, some random movement, but not meaningful interaction with her environment. Minimally conscious state is a more complex situation where some of the functions are still preserved, but not all of them. So it's a much, I think, more challenging condition to conceptualize, and also a more disturbing one in some sense, because if there's one solace in a persistent vegetative state is that consciousness is not present, so probably the capacity for suffering isn't there, whereas in a minimally conscious state, there would still be a capacity for suffering.
Dr. Burnett, would you like to amplify on that?
Sure. I think to best understand these disorders of consciousness, it might be worth briefly reviewing how consciousness is produced in the brain in an oversimplified way. There are two elements that we define clinically. One of them could be called wakefulness, and the second, awareness. And wakefulness is a necessary condition before one can have awareness. Wakefulness comes from a group of neurons in the brainstem, the so-called ascending reticular activating system, and its projections to the thalamus, so that when that area is damaged, people are in a coma, which is a state of neither wakefulness nor awareness. Now, awareness is served by the structures in the brain from the thalamus to the cerebral cortex and the connections between the thalamus and the cerebral cortex. someone who has striking destruction to either the, both thalamic nuclei or the white matter connections between those in the cortex or diffusely in the cortex will lose awareness. A person in a persistent vegetative state has the ironic combination of preserved wakefulness but absent awareness. Their wakefulness is preserved because their brainstem ascending reticular activating system has been spared by the condition that caused the brain damage. But they have no awareness because the condition that caused the brain damage severely damaged the cerebral cortex or the thalamus or the connections between them. It's difficult for people who haven't examined a patient like that to imagine how can there be a dissociation between wakefulness and awareness. We tend to think when we're awake, we're aware. And to see a patient or a picture of a patient whose eyes are open, who's blinking, whose eyes are moving, yet, and then have doctors tell us, oh, by the way, this person is totally unaware, just as if they were unconscious, that sounds counterintuitive and difficult to accept. And that problem, I think, has complicated the public understanding of this disorder. Now, the minimally conscious state is a state of damage to the cortex and thalamus and connections, but one in which there remains a degree of awareness. So these people are severely disabled, they're poorly responsive, yet they are aware. So it's all the difference in the world between the minimally conscious state and the persistent vegetative state, because in the minimally conscious state, there is some degree of awareness, whereas to the fullest extent we can test in the persistent vegetative state, there's no awareness.
And how do you test for that awareness?
Well, that's a difficult issue. First, let me say there's a biological limitation to our knowledge of awareness of another person. There's no way that one person can get inside the mind of another person and experience what they experience. So our ability to know the awareness of another person is by definition inferential. That is, we interact with that person in some way, and judging on the basis of the quality of their responses to our interaction, we infer a certain quality of conscious life. Now, at the bedside, a neurologist doing this type of testing would observe the patient. They would try to interact with the patient. They would talk and see if there's any response that suggests awareness, such as looking the examiner in the eye, following a target or the examiner's eyes around the room with movement, following commands, making an emotional response to some type of appropriate stimulus, such as talking about a loved one or seeing a photograph of a loved one, something that they do that could be done only by a person who was aware. Those are the types of signs that we try to elicit, and only when those are utterly absent can we confidently say the person is vegetative.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Krill, I know that you have not personally examined Terry Schiavo, but you say in your editorial in this week's New England Journal of Medicine that, quote, I have no doubt that Terry Schiavo is in a persistent vegetative state and that her cognitive and neurological functions are unfortunately not going to improve. How can you be sure?
Well, I have spoken to at least one neurologist who has examined her in detail, and she has been examined by multiple neurologists over 15 years. She has been very, very carefully assessed. People have spent lots of time with her who are skilled and have tested her ability to respond. They've also done some objective testing of her brain, particularly the state of her cortex, and the outer part of her brain is the cortex, and most of that was severely damaged in her original injury, such that it is now disappeared or atrophied, so that there isn't really much cortex left in her brain. They've also done electrical testing of her brain, EEGs, and there is virtually no electrical activity in her brain. So that, in combination with the multiple neurologists who have seen her, who have concluded she's in a persistent vegetative state, and 15 years of time allows one to be quite confident. And the courts have actually taken 6 days of testimony on this subject and have also concluded that she is in a persistent vegetative state beyond, you know, with a clear and convincing level of evidence.
Mm-hmm. Well, are you familiar? Do you remember the Nancy Cruzan case?
Sure.
It seems very similar to this one.
Well, it's similar in it's similar. The medical side of it
right.
is similar. The family dynamics couldn't be more different, and that's really what is so troubling here. In the Cruzan case, the family hoped for many years that she would get better, then accepted the doctor's diagnosis of a persistent vegetative state. They then asked the right question: what would Nancy Cruzan want under these circumstances? They felt very clear, and there was a consensus among family members that she would not want that treatment. And their challenge was to convince the court in a clear and convincing way that Nancy Cruzan would not want this. What makes this case more troubling is that the family is not just not working together, but working at cross purposes, trying to do the right thing. And I have no doubt that both sides in this dispute really are trying to do the right thing for Mrs. Schiavo. They just see the right thing as being radically different. Her husband feels he has an obligation to honor her wishes as he heard them and perceives them, and the family feels an obligation to try to, in some sense, preserve her life. So that's makes this a much more complex case socially. But I don't think it's more complex medically. I think medically they're very similar.
What are your feelings about doctors who go on television, you know, and do instant analyses of what this case is about? Who've never, spoken with anybody or had any firsthand knowledge from anybody who has seen anybody. Is this sort of a form of malpractice?
Well, there have been a lot of statements on television made by people based on very, very superficial knowledge, observing the tapes that are highly edited on television. The whole use of videotape on television here is just extremely disturbing in terms of its absence of privacy, dignity. And to make this distinction between minimally conscious state and persistent vegetative state, you really need to spend time with the patient, carefully examine over time, you know, really test in many, many different ways. So walking into this case with, having spent a very short period of time not examining, I think, is not responsible.
There's a public distribution because it's public. It's in the public domain of her CAT scan, her brain CAT scan. We have it up on our webpage at Science Friday. And it looks clear to anybody who looks at that that there's tremendous amount of brain damage there. Can you tell from a CAT scan how, the difference between these two states, or do you need more tools for making a diagnosis? Dr. Burnett.
Generally, these are clinical diagnoses. They're what we call syndromes, which means the findings on examination fit the pattern of a group of disorders, all of which that share certain features. So these are clinical syndromes for the most part. Now, there is a correlation between the findings on the clinical syndromes and certain neuroimaging findings on, say, a CT scan or an MRI of the brain showing a lot of damage. But, no, you don't make the diagnosis radiologically. It's a clinical one.
Mm-hmm.
So as a syndrome, this kind of condition, the persistent vegetative state or the minimally conscious state, or coma for that matter, can be caused by a variety of different disorders that have different outcomes, some of which may get better, others of which don't, so that one can't look at a syndromic condition like persistent vegetative state or coma and make a unified statement about all cases do this, this, or the other. It depends on a number of factors, the most important of which is what caused it, and is that which caused it irreversible? And secondly, for how long has it been going on?
Mm-hmm. We're talking about brain disorders this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let's go to the phones. Mike in Salem, Oregon. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead.
I'm a neurologist, and I've been practicing for about 10 years. I appreciate this topic because in watching the headlines over the last week, what's been most distressing of a number of things is the lack of an explanation in layperson's terms of what's been happening with this lady's brain. So I think your guests are doing a very nice job. It seems like the public would be better able to make a decision about this if they understood, you know, on more of a scientific level what's been happening. So that's just one quick comment. The second comment is your first guest touched upon this very early. You know, some people say, well, gee whiz, if she's got some awareness, then we have to keep going, quote unquote. I would offer, as I see these cases on almost a monthly basis, that, or remind people that, would that be better? Would a certain amount of awareness in a situation where you're locked in, which Dr. Burnett might even touch upon that syndrome, would that be a better state of existence than being in a truly vegetative state? I would offer that most patients, in fact, every patient I've ever seen or family who's commented on this says, absolutely not. That'd be even a worse horror to have some degree of awareness yet be 100% dependent upon others. I have never seen a family who said, yes, we want to continue, our loved one would want to live in that state. I think that point bears emphasis, I guess, or repeating, that having some degree of awareness, to my mind, would actually be a worse situation.
Dr. Quill, you make sort of that point at the end of your perspective piece in the journal.
Yeah, I think, you know, at least I can draw a little bit of solace if I believe she's in a persistent vegetative state, which I do. That she is not suffering, whereas I think the people in minimally conscious state are in a much more complex situation, and I think the capacity for suffering, which again requires some cognition, I think is much greater. I think even if she were in this minimally conscious state, after a period of time, these same questions arise, though. Would she want us to continue under these circumstances? Would she want us to stop? So the even though it is a very important distinction, the same question would arise. It doesn't mean that because she's in a minimally conscious state that we wouldn't be asking the same questions. We do ask these questions all the time when we're working with families of a patient in a minimally conscious state, particularly over a period of time, because over time the probability of more recovery goes way down.
All right, I'm going to have to take a break. Stay with us. We'll be right back after the short break talking more about brain functioning. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about just what it means to be in a persistent vegetative state. With my guest, James Burnett, a professor of neurology at Dartmouth Medical School, Timothy Quill, professor of medicine, psychiatry, and medical humanities at the University of Rochester Medical Center. He's also director of the Center for Palliative Care and Clinical Ethics there. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get some phone calls in. Let's go to Sarah. Hi, Sarah. Hi, welcome. You're in Maryland, University Park.
Yes.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi. Do the doctors know if any pain medication is being given to the patient at this time? And what would be the harm of giving pain medication? Just thirst and hunger are pretty low-level drives, and if they can't be expressed, I would still think just palliative care would be in, you know, just covering the bases.
Dr. Quill?
Certainly, I think we should all be glad that she is in a hospice, because hospices are very experienced with taking care of people who are at the very end of their lives, and particularly those who are not able to eat and drink anymore. I think they will be very attentive to any sense of dryness that she has. They'll be moistening her mouth. They'll be giving her exquisite skin care, moisturizing her skin. And if there is any sense that she is in pain or suffering, there would be a very low threshold for providing her with some pain medicine. Again, patients in a persistent vegetative state are extremely unlikely to be experiencing pain. So I would think only if she appeared to show signs of pain would pain medicine be given in this particular circumstance. But in other circumstances, the threshold would be any sense that she's in pain. They would be very attentive to that and would provide pain medicine.
Thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255. How many cases around the country do you think there are that don't get this kind of attention? That this basically where the people are in the same situation?
I think we often start a feeding tube or other life-sustaining therapies in situations of uncertainty when you don't know what the outcome is going to be. So you try these things, and we do our best to try to help a patient to recover. And then if it looks like they're not going to recover, we then address this question that they've been struggling with, and that was, what would the patient want us to do? If a patient's awake, they can and aware, they can tell us the answer to that. But if they can't, then we have to fathom that. We stop life-sustaining therapies, including feeding tubes. It's not all the time, but on a regular basis. So we have a lot of experience with this decision-making process and with comforting people once they've made that decision.
Are you familiar with the Sun Hudson case in Texas, where there was an infant that was, over the objections of the parents, was deprived of life-saving efforts?
I'm not in depth familiar with it, so I'm not sure that I could comment on it.
Okay. But it would seem to be logical that if there are so many cases where people are on feeding tubes, why don't we hear more about them, and why is there not such a furor about when they happen?
Most of the time, what you do is sit down. If a patient can speak for him or herself, that person has the right to determine what will happen to their own body. If they can't speak, and you've gone on a while and you kind of know they're not going to recover, you're then sitting down with the family and you're trying to figure out what would that person want us to do. The Quinlan court had it right. They said if the patient could sit up for 15 minutes, understand her situation completely, and then had to go back into it, what would he or she tell you to do? That's the right question. And if you can get a consensus that it's right, that the person would want to stop, then you can stop and provide hospice care. If you know the patient would want to keep going, then you keep going, even if they're not going to recover. So we have lots of people that we continue treatment with who are in persistent vegetative state. If you're not sure, if there's a lot of disagreement and there's no good data about what the patient actually would want, generally we don't have public policy, we keep going.
Mm-hmm. And who's paying, and generally who pays for this care at the end of life? And in the Chavo case, who's paying here? Do we know?
Well, Medicare and Medicaid, we all pay into Medicare and Medicaid one way or another, and that's who pays for the majority of the care.
But there was a legal remedy here that was awarded money, which her husband has been paying out of his remaining funds, and also she was given money for care herself, wasn't she?
There was a trust fund set up for her, and that has been geared toward her potential rehabilitation. I think she tried some experimental therapy. There have been some other things that have been tried with that money. I believe that most of those funds and both of those pots are essentially gone.
So now how would we then, if those pots are gone, how would we then, if she were to be put back on a feeding tube, how would she be taken care of, and who would be paying for that?
We have a collective system, Medicare and Medicaid. It's not perfect, but it does pay for good care for people who are in this condition.
1-800-989-8255 is the number. Let's go to Kathy in Ann Arbor. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Ira. This is a very important show, and I really, really wish more of the media would take the time to explain these important differences. And I just want to make a comment. When you introduced the show, you used the term that Jeb Bush had found a doctor who had given an opinion, new evidence that Terry Schiavo was not in a persistent vegetative state, but in a partially conscious state. And really, it wasn't evidence. It was just this guy's opinion. And I think that that's the kind of verbiage that the media needs to be really careful about.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I agree. I did not mean to give the impression it was new evidence. But you're right. You know, I get me trying to. He was presenting what he thought was new evidence. But you're absolutely right about getting the terminology right.
Part of what you're doing today is getting the terminology right.
Yeah, and even this whole concept, I'm glad you brought it up, the whole concept of starvation. In the newscast before, at the beginning of the program, they talked about starvation.
Right.
And starvation connotes you're dying of hunger.
I know. My mother had a feeding tube, Ira, so I've been there. And my mother had ALS, and your neurologist can explain what that means, that when it gets into a really progressive state. And so our family went through this, and I am just glad that the government didn't stick their noses in our business at that point in time.
Well,
and that's all I have to say.
All right. Thank you for calling.
Uh-huh.
1-800-989-8255. Dr. Quill, let's talk about starvation. You, I guess in exact terms, you are starving her, but she doesn't feel hungry, does she?
Yeah, the people, again, we have a fair experience with people who are still aware and alert and made their own decision to stop a feeding tube, and let's say that's the only way they can eat. They do feel some hunger for perhaps the first day or so. And then a process called ketosis sets in, where the body tries to generate its own food. And in this state of being ketotic, hunger goes away. So the sense of hunger goes away. The whole language use of starvation is so inflammatory and so misleading. This is really quite a comfortable, dignified process for most people. And things that do come up can be relatively easily managed if you're in a caring environment, which Mrs. Schiavo fortunately is in a hospice. So this is a dignified way to die. It is humane. Before feeding tubes, if you had a catastrophic neurologic event and you survived, chances are you might die this way. And so there's an extremely long history of death occurring this way. It in a certain way is the most natural of ways of dying. And a feeding tube, it could be construed as the part that's not natural.
Mm-hmm.
It's a temporizing measure in some sense.
Mm-hmm. What kind of research? So let me bring Dr. Burnett in also. What other kinds of research do you think we should do about understanding just this borderline differences and different kinds of consciousness? What
well,
do we need
of,
to know?
Some of the exciting work that's ongoing is using functional MRI imaging to study the activation of neuronal networks as a result of various types of stimuli. There are several centers in the world that are looking at patients with persistent vegetative state and with minimally conscious state and performing these studies. The paradigm of this type of research is to provide a standardized type of stimulus, if it's an auditory stimulus by sentences that the person is read, and then that's one stimulus. Another would be a sensory stimulus of touch, and then one measures the activation of various cortical networks using the technique of functional MRI. And there's only preliminary data from these studies thus far. That is, they're research tools that have not yet been standardized sufficiently to be useful clinically. But the preliminary data shows that in the minimally conscious state, where people are aware, that their activation of neural networks as a result of the stimuli are quite close to normal. And a recent report about 2 months ago pointed that out in two patients, and the investigators were somewhat surprised because the response the patients made was not very much. They knew they were aware, but their responsiveness was still very poor, yet the activation of these distributed networks in the brain was quite normal. Now, that's important to distinguish and contrast in the case of PVS. In people in persistent vegetative state, who, although awake, are unaware, those people do not have the activation in these distributed neural networks recorded by functional MRI. You can see some selective activation of individual small cortical areas, but no association, no connections, and no large-scale activation. So these types of studies correlate with the clinical beliefs that people in persistent vegetative state are unaware, and people in minimally conscious state are aware. Perhaps they're very aware.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about different states of the brain this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. And I guess then that the functional MRI might be used as a diagnostic tool then to distinguish between the two.
Well, I think that's a reasonable expectation for the future. once they enough patients are studied and some findings can be standardized to be able to determine statistical parameters such as positive and negative predictive values. That is, if your scan shows a particular pattern, what is the probability that this means that you're unaware or you are aware? That's the kind of data that needs to be accomplished before they can be used clinically.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Quill, when this plays itself out and when Ms. Chiavro does eventually succumb, are we going to be moving on? Are there going to be lessons learned here, or are we just going to wait for the next case?
Well, you know, we've had two big cases in the past. Well, there have been more than two, but two that have really captured the public's imagination, the Karen Ann Quinlan case and the Nancy Cruzan case. And we now have some public policy in this area of withdrawing life-sustaining therapy that works really quite well, that, you know, any person can make a decision about treatments that invade their body. They can stop them at any time if they have the capacity to make that decision. And families are empowered to make those decisions if a patient can't make it. And they should not make what they would want. They make what the patient would want. So that public policy works pretty well. What do you do in the tough cases when the families disagree about what the patient would want? I think those are the rare cases where you take them to court. And most of the time this should be worked out in the context of a hospital, caring team, ethics committee, perhaps, on the tougher cases. And then the really tough ones go to court. The courts actually did their job here. They analyzed her state, you know, the state of her injury very carefully, 6 days of testimony, many, many experts evaluating her. And then they evaluated in an independent, at a different time, what were her wishes? And they said this met a clear and convincing standard that she would not want this. That got appealed and then reappealed, and that should have been the end of it. That's our system for dealing with this. It's a hard system, but this is a very important decision. All this extra legal activity, the Florida legislature and then Congress, has no business in this kind of a process, in my opinion.
Well, we might see more of it in the future.
I think the courts the courts have said no to that. They really, in both cases, they said that's a violation of the separation of powers, and I think they've said that very clearly and consistently. And these have been courts, you know, dominated by people on both sides of the political spectrum. So I don't think anybody wants their future to hang on a legislature or Congress where people really have made some of the comments that have been made in both of those settings are just upsetting.
If Terry Schiavo had a living will that seemed to clearly indicate she would not want to be kept alive in this condition, instead of us depending on the word of her husband, would all of this have been avoided, or do you think her parents would still intervene by saying she was misdiagnosed or something like that?
I think it's hard to know. I think it sure would have been a lot easier if she had done that. That clearly is one of the messages for all of us, if you haven't done one, to let your wishes be known and to talk to your family about how you feel about cases like this and things like this. You know, it still is going to be tough if there's real genuine disagreement within a family. But I think if you have gone to the trouble of naming somebody and setting your views and values out, generally that will be honored. And I think it's the best protection we have.
Any final thoughts, Dr. Burnett?
Just to point out that most of the time, the decision-making about these tragic cases is conducted successfully within a hospital, and that is there's a consensus within the family, and it's all very satisfactory. It's very rare for them to get this degree of public attention. I would hope that people would be aware that in 99.9% of the time, these things are handled fairly well. The ones that are intractable disputes go to court where they're handled fairly well. Mm-hmm. So that is the norm.
All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. We've run out of time. James Burnett is a professor of neurology at Dartmouth Medical School. Timothy Quill, professor of medicine, psychiatry, and medical humanities, University of Rochester Medical Center, also director of the Center for Palliative Care and Clinical Ethics there. Thanks, gentlemen, for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Our program is produced by Annette Heist. Senior producer Kevin Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our director and web producer. Our interns are Corey Binns and Todd Neal. If you missed any of the references we make, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. You'll also find Science Friday's Kids Connection there. Free curricula we make for teachers. Click on the Teachers button on the left side. Also, you can take Science Friday with you on your iPod or listen to it, back issues of it on Real Audio. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.